Hello and welcome to Education Scotland's The Pedagogy Podcast. I'm your host, Bex Ewart, and I will be leading us through some really interesting conversations around about pedagogy with a really wide and broad spectrum of educational professionals, children and young people. This podcast came about as a response to the OECD report, which found that in order to improve the quality of outcomes for our children, practitioners and teachers need to be supported to explore their own pedagogy and their practice through a pedagogical lens. Unsurprisingly, in the early years, it's been a focus, and so there's a lot of research and policy documents and research papers around about the subject of pedagogy. But as we move through the school stages and into secondary school and further education, that reference to pedagogy drops off. We'll be talking to a whole host of educational professionals from the early years through primary, young children and people from various different stages in their education, and then right into further education, exploring pedagogy, what it means to different people, and what we might change and what we might challenge ourselves around to ensure that our education meets the needs of our children and young people as we move into an exciting but unknown future. Welcome to this episode of Education Scotland's The Pedagogy Podcast, and I'm really excited to be talking with Carl Gombrich today. Thank you for your time, Carl. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and introduce kind of the thinking behind why you're here this afternoon.
Thanks, Bex, and thanks for inviting me. I'm not quite a spring chicken anymore. I'm the wrong side of 55, so I've got a lot to say about this question. So you literally might have to jump in and stop me, Bex, if I go on too long. And because I've had quite an unusual life in some ways, certainly an unusual trajectory to get to where I am now. Again, I guess many older people have a much more interesting life than me, but I'm not a traditional academic. I've only been in higher education really since my 40s. I'm now, as I say, now nearer 60. So as not to kind of totally lose your listeners, I think the main tension in my life, if you like, has always been between music and performing music, particularly classical music, though not exclusively, and what I prefer to call the intellectual rather than the academic world, because as I say, I have unusual academic trajectory. So for a long time, most of my 20s and even into my early 30s, I was jumping between doing degrees in maths and physics and studying music, notably piano at the Guildhall School of Music, and then more seriously singing, opera singing. And I was a Royal Opera House scholar, no less, at the National Opera Studio, which is a very posh, a very good postgraduate school for opera singing, where they only take 12 or so people a year. And that was, when was that now? I think it was the very early thousands, 2001 or so. So, but in the end, and partly because of my family background, which I won't give you all now, but people can Google me if they want to, partly due to the sort of blood is thicker than water thing, I'd found myself happier and happier in the intellectual world, eventually in academia. And then was at UCL for about 16 years, from the early thousands to 2019. And during that time, I moved from being a physics teacher to setting up running programs. And then in particular, well, we're getting up to today, setting up, designing, leading the team that set up the design and implementation of the first real sort of liberal arts and sciences course in the UK. The first Bachelor of Arts and Sciences. So we created a new type of degree, the BASC. So UCAS had to change its systems and all those kinds of things, which kind of count, I suppose, in the national picture. And although, you know, if you look across the pond in America or even in the Netherlands, such courses aren't that unusual. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very challenging and fascinating thing to do in the UK context. Not just that, I think it had some genuinely innovative ideas about interdisciplinarity in the number of core courses that all our students had to take. There was a sort of core spine. So it wasn't really a pick and mix course. There was a lot of element of choice and students could jump across disciplines, but it wasn't just kind of a liberal arts free for all. There was a real structure to it, which was really interesting. And I think that's where I sort of added value, if you like, that I sort of insisted on that structure, having worked with a big steering group to create it. And that meant defending some positions quite strongly mm-hmm. about, for example, the mixture of sciences and arts or humanities that a student had to do on the program, or a certain number of interdisciplinary courses they had to do, or a foreign language that they had to do even. And that could have really backfired. So if you like, there was more skin in that game. It had more sort of jeopardy, if you like, which then when it worked out well, meant a good feeling, a feeling that it was right to defend those things. And it was really interesting to see just what students could achieve given the right context and stimulation mm-hmm. to be interdisciplinary learners. So that was a great success. I'm very happy with UCL were very good to me. I was one of the very early professorial teaching fellows. I think I was the very first round, actually. They were very kind to bestow on me the professorial title. But I had a sort of taste by then of educational entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. if you like, and not having, as I say, not having been an academic. I don't have a PhD, for example. I only have two masters, which these days actually isn't. I regularly speak to people who have three, four, or five masters. But anyway, I have sort of, you know, undergraduate, two masters in this music stuff, but I don't have a traditional academic trajectory. And so I wasn't really interested in sitting around to become increasingly this sort of old man of interdisciplinary education. The invitations are great. You know, UCL, you get lovely invites from all over the world to start going and talk about what you're doing. But I had a taste for the entrepreneurial. And so when Ed Fido, the CEO of the London Interdisciplinary School, where I am now, when he met me and we went out for a few dinners, and he said, look, I want to set up a completely new school, kind of along the lines that you've been doing, but even more radical with a few sort of slightly different mission statements. Mm-hmm. It just seemed too good an opportunity for me to miss, too exciting, too challenging, too kind of necessary, really, and urgent to challenge the system a bit more. So I jumped out and joined Ed and Chris Pearson, the chairman, in April 2019. So it's been nearly 4 years now. And that brings me up just about to your question, where do you find yourself now?
Yes. Crikey. So there's quite a lot to unpick there. But I think one of the where I'd like to start is, what was your motivation for shifting the view of further education from the more specific traditional, you get a degree in maths, to you study across the disciplines?
That is a really, really good question. Funnily enough, not a question that many people ask me. So it's nice to try and answer a new question. Very much a mixture of the personal and the professional, I think. So personally, because of this split in my personality, if you like, in my mind, of always being interested in the arts, mostly through music, but also literature. I love literature and read a lot when I was younger, and always being interested in the sciences through physics and maths mostly. I was frustrated at school by not being able to do a wide range of subjects. And I did physics, biology, and English literature, which in my day was virtually impossible. I mean, now more students do a little bit like that. But even there, mm-hmm. you know, you're not doing maths and physics. You're just doing the physics. You're not doing biology and chemistry. You're just doing the biology. Yeah. And English sort of stands on its own. So there I was sort of straining, you know, to be broader than the system would allow. So all my life, I guess that's been a thing for me, you know. And then partly my wider family background. My granddad was a very great scholar from the more German tradition of what's called Bildung, which is about kind of breadth of education and formation. And I think that influenced me quite a lot, quite deeply. And then I think completely differently, but I'm of the generation that lived through the rise of the internet and the coming of Web 2.0 and how learning, I think, should, but probably hasn't changed, should change, probably hasn't changed very much. And the sort of affordances of the internet, which mm-hmm. obviously to me, but less obviously it seems to some people, were smashing through all those old silos and boundaries and barriers. And as a student said to me the other day, you know, when I look at my Wikipedia reading history, I don't see any disciplines there. And I was like, yeah, of course, you know, if you're mm-hmm. an interested, engaged learner these days, you're going to be all over the shop putting things together and making sense in whatever way you can, basically, of the world. And so without wishing to get rid of structure per se, maybe we'll come back to that, because I think to learn at all, you have to have structure and some kind of discipline. But it seemed to me that to assume that that structure was the old-fashioned disciplinary structure just seemed incredibly outdated. And at best, it didn't reflect what was going on. And at worst, it was actually hampering students from really being their best learning selves and finding their most interesting niches and combinations that meant most to them. So yeah, those two things together made me really excited about the whole interdisciplinary project at UCL. Though when it was, you know, mooted to me in 2010, I wasn't sort of the whole stuff, the last 13 years I've been doing, the conceptual work I've done and the practical implementation, it wasn't, you know, it was just an apple in my eye, really. It was a long, it has been, continues to be. I'm just writing an email to my team right now about the next steps we take in this journey of thinking about interdisciplinarity. You know, it wasn't something I grew up with. And I was in my 40s already when I got excited by these concepts and the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. I think that leads us quite nicely on to then thinking about the nature of learning and what it is to be a successful learner and someone who flourishes through their learning. What then does pedagogy start to mean to you? And has your position shifted across that?
Yes. So you'll know, and your listeners probably know better than me, the sort of contentious nature of this word. And some people think it's just a pretentious word for teaching. some people think it should be more about learning than teaching. Though, of course, the roots of the word are associated with teaching. For me, the word simply means sort of the science of teaching. Let's put it that way. And perhaps I should say the art and science of teaching, really. I've read a lot of stuff about pedagogy and education in general. So for me, what it means now is, good pedagogy is teaching well. Let's be really as straightforward as we can about it. But what that means is, I think, really challenged by the environment we find ourselves in. And I think that most schools and most systems are running completely scared of what's happened in the world in the last 20 years and haven't worked out how to use many of the affordances of the internet to change their thinking, their teaching. And I think ChatGPT, which everyone's talking about now, is the next evolution. And daily now we're having great discussions in faculty and with students about what this means for their learning and our teaching and our assessments. And again, no one has any idea yet. I suspect it'll be something along the lines of the calculator anxiety we had in the 80s and 90s, where you know calculators should be banned and we should go back to smoke signals and tying knots in string as the only valid way of working things out. And then we settled down. We had a mixture of calculator and non-calculator exams. I think there's still an issue with that, and perhaps it could be used more intelligently. I do understand now that some graphical calculators are so good that students can do all sorts of things in exams. Perhaps they shouldn't. And the boards have to keep on top of these issues. Again, your listeners will know more about this than me. I have a son just going through GCSE. He's very interested in math, so I hear a bit about it. But basically, I think that debate settled down fairly productively, at least for 20 years or so. And maybe ChatGPT will do the same, though, of course, it's so new and evolving so fast. At the moment, it's hard to see where it will stop or settle. So for me, yeah, pedagogy is just about teaching well. And for me, that involves getting the learner to learn rather than teaching them. And of course, this sounds very progressive and very, some people don't like that straight away and say, what is the role of the teacher? But the teacher for me has to be light touch. And a teacher has to be there. So it's always discussions, they seem to get polarized, black and white. You know, oh, you mean there's no room for a teacher anymore? Of course there's a role for a teacher. I take that role extremely responsibly. But at the same time, you want to sort of taper out in your significance to the student. Make yourself redundant is a phrase I like, almost as soon as you can, in the sense you want them to be empowered to ask the right questions, have self-criticality, know where to go to get the best sources and best authority. And if you are genuinely the best source and best authority on the very thing in the world which the student wants, then fair enough. But honestly, there aren't that many people on the planet who can hold their hand and say, yes, the student should come to me for all sources of authority and everything they want to learn. So it's much more about those other things I say, empowering the student, getting them to be self-critical, getting them to have discipline, to learn how to learn and do the work. Which is the most important role of a teacher, I think. But I mean, a student did ask me the other day, how did he phrase it? He phrased it better than I did, but it was something like, so do you see yourself as giving us access to education or as educating us? And there I said, I came down very clearly on that. I see myself as educating you because I don't need to give you access to education. You've got the internet. You can spend your entire life learning things I could never have imagined when I was your age to a very high level for free in your own time. So I'm here to educate you, whatever that means in the modern context. So that was quite helpful because it actually made me come out as a perhaps sounding a bit more traditionalist in that way. But I just think that teaching is not the same as it was 40 years ago.
No, and I think that role of the adult is something that we need to really take time to interrogate and understand how we position ourselves in that. For me, I'm an early years specialist, so our role of the adult looks significantly more like you're talking about empowerment, you know, potentially offering a provocation and then supporting exploration to reach some kind of independence and autonomy within that learning.
Some kind of self-realization at the end of that process.
Yeah. And I think that we've done an awful lot of thinking in the early years about what that means for our positions as adults in the space, and also the fact that we have to meet children and young people where they are and respect them as that individual in time, not as a potential. So it's that sort of your childhood isn't on the way to adulthood. It is in and of itself a very important stage. But then our identities as teachers, and certainly when I was back in teacher education, it was about me holding the knowledge at the front of the class and transmitting it across. And then to kind of shift that thinking, you have to really be quite confident in yourself and quite put a lot of trust in your learners as well, that they will run with the opportunities that you afford them rather than miss out.
That's really interesting, that thing about meeting them where they are. And that's very live for us at LIS, because our curriculum is very radical. We don't teach subjects, we teach real world problems and methods to tackle those problems. And most of our students are 18, 19 year olds, come from a very hidebound traditional system where they are told what to say for the exam. That's what learning has become, really. Can I reproduce this for the exam? I mean, I see it with my kids. They talk about knowledge in terms of a 3 marker or a 5 marker.
Yeah.
What? And you get, you know, why haven't I got 100% in my English essay? And I'm like, what does that even mean to get 100% in an English essay? So that's the culture they're coming from. And we are like, this is not going to help you. In 3 years' time, when you go out and try and get a job, there's no one you can ask what the right answer is for this. They're going to say, go out and find this out for me. Come back and present something that excites me or my clients, brings value to my organization, my charity, my business, whatever. But of course, it's very difficult for students to get this quickly. And actually, in a way, using that phrase you had has made me think, you know, maybe we don't do enough to meet them exactly where they are. We certainly try. We try and do a lot of scaffolding, lots and lots and lots of explanation for what we're doing and the meta. And we give tons of examples of graduates who've successfully gone through these types of degrees and the things they're doing now. But the lived reality for these students, 18, 19, is, in my view, they have no idea of the sort of learning that's required as an adult in the modern world. They've been sort of infantilized almost as a learner. And that transition, if you like, from school system to uni and beyond, two transitions there, I guess, but places that I've been responsible for, I want to make the transition from uni to the next part of the life more productive. So that transition then from school to uni becomes even harder if you're trying to do kind of those two steps in one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a really, really big challenge. And I like that phrase, meeting them where they are. But I also, I suppose I do. So this maybe slightly contradicts what you said. I do want them to think about where they're going and to think how they get there. So why wouldn't you do that with their younger learners? Is there just an assumption that they'll work that out for themselves?
No, I think it's an assumption that there's almost two curricula running side by side. So there's the adult's curriculum, and we know the skills and the sometimes pieces of knowledge that they will need as they continue in their learning journey. So for example, we will need to get them ready to be able to learn phonics. So we do a lot of work around phonological awareness, rhyme, but that's almost a byproduct of
what it is to meet somebody at that age and that stage in a good education system, in the same way that you're talking about your children and their understanding of what their education is at the moment. You know, the grades have become the end, but actually learning is the end and grades are a byproduct of a good education. So I think that's what I mean in terms of we want to be able to empower our learners and meet them where we are, which means respecting where they are right now, rather than trying to get them ready. Traditionally, there has been this push to get children from early learning ready for primary school, where there's that sharp shift in pedagogy into much more formalized teaching. And in Scotland, we're really lucky that our policy landscape is such that we're really pushing exploratory, play-based learning, developmentally appropriate learning through the early stages of primary. But it's again that shift in thinking. It's how does that work? And then if we afford those children that experience, then is it fair then that they start to come into this incredibly structured system towards the end of primary and then into secondary? And so we have these systematic factors. Like how do you offer a really broad general education that caters for the needs of your individual young person when you're stuck in a system of 1,000 children, timetabling, you know, all of that jazz? It's an almost an impossible situation.
It is. This is the fascination of education, isn't it? Because it's never solved. It's never right. But there's always hope, right? It's amazing. It is sort of addictive as a career because there's always hope, and then there's always disappointment, and then there's always hope again. So if you like that sort of thing, as I guess I do, sort of constant problem solving, big problems too, then it's a great career. But I'm sympathetic to schools needing a lot of structure, you know, particularly sort of with adolescents. I think it's so easy for them because of their developmental stage to, you know, to run a bit wild really and make. I'm all for making mistakes, but they have to be kind of in some kind of safe-ish environment, you know, where it doesn't matter to make the mistake. And structure can really help with that. I mean, the sorts of degree programs I run, to be honest, they do resonate more with the sort of 23, 24 and up, just as the people are getting to the end of adolescence and they're like, oh, yeah, of course the world isn't black or white. Of course I've got to work this out. Of course I've got to take responsibility for my learning and make some of my own connections. The world is complex, you know, particularly people who've been working for a couple of years in sort of white-collar work already. They get a lot of the language that we use. And I'm very conscious of this. I think one of the greatest challenges that we have, or the courses I've been involved with have, is simply, you know, sort of fighting development, adult development in some ways. Mm-hmm. There is a natural trajectory from your world, early years, right through to sort of full adulthood, which is probably 25 plus in terms of brain development. And you can't really force that. You can't teach kids as if they're adults. You can't teach adults as if they were kids, and all the complexities in between. So I suppose, I mean, I think the modern world does have requirements that maybe 50 years ago didn't exist that require young people to have what Robert Keegan calls, I think, more advanced mental complexity earlier if they're going to really cope and understand it. And I try and give that to them, but you can only push it so far, because if they're just not ready to receive mental complexity, it won't land.
So we've talked a lot about the challenges and the structural barriers, but you were talking about the kind of the reading that has done that has inspired your thinking about pedagogy. So what are the ones that have inspired you and have influenced your thinking the most?
So mostly on the more scientific side. So I'm a big fan of the Make It Stick book, which I might get here. Brown, Roediger and McDaniel. I'm sure your listeners know that. And more recently, a sort of updated, more personal version by Scott Young called Super Learners? Ultra Learning, that's right. So this is a young man who did use the internet too. He was stuck in a rather boring business school in Canada, maybe doing a very normal degree. And he thought, this is daft. You know, I could do much better. Let's try and do the MIT course in computer science, undergraduate degree, on my own, just with free resources. I think, you have to check this. He said, I'll do a 3-year degree in 1 year. Maybe it was 2 years, but anyway, it was definitely accelerated. And he did it. And he got the degree from MIT in computer science, the kind of elite you know, science degree in the world on his own from his bedroom in 1 year. And in the process, he learnt that what he is a great learner rather than a great computer scientist or great business person or anything else. So the whole book is about how to learn and how to become a better artist or a better public speaker or whatever. And so, you know, this leverages a lot of the things we know now about space practice, about interleaving, about mental effort, cognitive effort, many things which actually teachers are very well aware of now and try and tell their students. And I think having some success, actually, if my kids are anything to go by, I think this generation might have better information that, you know, if you're going to spend time revising, don't spend time underlining for an hour. Spend 10 minutes just trying to recall things and write them down. Then go out for 50 minutes to have an ice cream and be with your mates. And although that 10 minutes is the most painful 10 minutes you'll ever have, and it feels much better to sit in front of your books for an hour underlining, it's much, much better for your learning to do the 10 minutes.
Yeah,
so these kinds of things we try to use in our teaching and try and tell people about. But on the other side, on the more kind of liberation side, I was very impressed by a book by Dan Wilinski about colonialism and knowledge. Now, what is that? Well, I've got it here. Let me just go and get the title. Hold on.
Perfect. Thank you.
It's called Learning to Divide the World, Education at Empire's End. John Wilinski, sorry. And that's more in the sort of, you know, the line of thinking which we hear a lot about in today's society about decolonizing the curriculum and liberation pedagogy and so on. And it's just a very impressive look at how Western Empire went to all the colonies basically, and sort of established categories of thinking. Really, it's interesting to me because a lot of it is about disciplines where they didn't exist before, and these categories sort of were rather did a bit of violence really to the local indigenous people because they didn't think in that way. And I think that's important to recognize now as the world becomes more connected and we can become more conscious, if we weren't already, of the horrors that were carried out by the colonists. I think I'm interested in some of the lived experience stuff and the more kind of community subjective starting points for how we think about what counts in knowledge. That's more about knowledge though, and epistemology in a way than pedagogy, actually, if we're going to be a bit making that distinction. So that's more about curricula and surfacing types of knowledge, or what's sometimes called epistemic justice or injustice, rather than the teaching. I'm not sure I've learned so much about teaching from that kind of literature. My teaching, my pedagogy knowledge is more of the kind of scientific and psychological insights from that.
But I suppose your definition of pedagogy was teaching well, and it's quite it has kind of echoes of virtue ethics in there, the teaching well. And so in there, there's almost a moral responsibility to be aware of the what you're teaching and where it comes from and the underlying assumptions and biases that they carry.
100%. Yeah, 100%. And it's an infinitely complex area these days. You know, you never know if someone in the room will feel very strongly about something you've said or not, and how you create those spaces where people can express themselves and where people are, there's so many different levels of tolerance of challenge that students are willing or able to hear. Some people want challenge all the time. They like a kind of really almost aggressive, but certainly very robust truth telling. And some students can't hear anything really that challenges something that they feel is personally very important to them. Handling that within one classroom is a pedagogical challenge, shall we say.
Absolutely.
We do try some of that. I don't think we do it systematically enough at the university. We've tried a couple of ideas, at least we floated trying a couple of ideas. I'm not sure if they're actually even carried out in class in the end, where we'd have a sort of tables with, you know, very robust aggressive challenge right down to no harm will be heard at this table, you know. I have to get back to my colleague, see whether he did that. But you're right. I mean, all this comes into pedagogy is how, I mean, if the aim of teaching in the end is these things of empowerment, self-criticality, growth, how you achieve that knowledge too, but mm-hmm. what sort of knowledge is interesting, but how you achieve those things all comes under pedagogy. And in some cases, all these discussions about lived experience and different cultural perspectives comes into play.
Absolutely. So we've had a really interesting discussion that's taken in a lot. And part of the reason for having this is to start conversations across staff teams, across the education system in Scotland and beyond. So what is the key message that you would give others to inform that thinking around their pedagogical practice?
Right. This is one I did take notes about, and I kind of wish I had those notes to hand. key message. I would say talk less if you possibly can. And maybe funny, because I probably come across as quite garrulous. But I really hope that in my lessons, I encourage lots of voices to speak from the floor, and I find a way to do it. One thing we use at our university is a box microphone, which is a nice cuddly foam square mic, which you throw to people and they catch, and only the people with the mic can speak.
Ooh, and I like that.
It's great because, you know, some people otherwise always dominate a class, and you can just say, sorry, I want the mic back now. And as teacher, that's your authority. So that is exercising some authority. Again, you know, some people might think that's too authoritative. I strongly disagree that classes need managing, otherwise mm-hmm. they get hijacked by people for the wrong reasons. And along with that, I guess this is a skill one gradually learns. You can encourage people who don't usually speak to take the mic. There are ways to go up to them very gently and just hand them it, say, come on, you say something or something, you know, and gradually bring in as many voices as possible. Another part of not speaking too much is to encourage students to actually give kind of mini presentations and find fora in which those can be helpfully critiqued in front of the whole class. We try to do that at LIS by doing what we call preparatory work, prep work, submitted in advance, and then picking some of those better ones for students to present in the class. Another way, again, school teachers actually way ahead of many universities in these things, but, you know, having group tables where you have a very clear thing that you want to be discussed, a topic or an idea, and you have various formats you can do that. So you can have, say, a group of five, three people maybe discussing the thing, one person's just listening, whose sole job is to keep the discussion on track.
Yeah.
So it can intervene when things go off, but otherwise doesn't contribute. And one person to take notes, perhaps with a view to presenting back to the class later. So various things like that, I think, are really important. And I would, that's the main advice I would give. No matter how much we like to talk and show people what we know things, we know, actually back to the sciences, we know now that very rarely is the best way to learn anything. It's not useless. And in a two-hour class, as we do at UCL, I'll often speak for, you know, chunks of 10 minutes, sometimes even 20 minutes. But giving that variety, another thing from the learning sciences, you know, I forget the technical word for this, but basically it's having a variety of experiences, a variety of environments, a variety of presentations helps the learning land. And so breaking up your speaking with these other activities and students speaking and students doing things is, I think, so key. I probably said nothing to your listeners, which is remotely interesting, original there, Bex, but in my world in university, where the lecture is still the overwhelming mode of so-called teaching, these things are still very unusual and not very well thought through.
Okay, so there's work to do for every sector.
I mean, we've got some of our best teachers are people who worked in the school sector for a while, actually, and you know, we try to get them to help us to be better university teachers, which is great for school students. I'm very happy for them. And I hope that now does start to inform the university sector a bit more.
Great. So you're currently at London Interdisciplinary School, mm-hmm. and that seems to be going well. What's next? Have you got any other projects on the boil?
Well, the London Interdisciplinary School is a huge, huge project because We're the first uni in 40 years to be given our own degree awarding powers. Doesn't happen very often that people set up a uni because it's so difficult. So this is at least for me another, I hesitate to put any number on it, but let's say at least 3 years, I think, because, you know, we've got 2 years of undergrads now and our first master's cohort this year. So I definitely want to see the first 2 years graduate, probably the first 3 years. Then I hope we'll be established by then. But there's a lot to do with, you know, more master's programs and professional development coming on stream now. Every step is a challenge with, you know, recruitment, getting sort of credibility from peers, explaining what we do. It's a very, very exciting, but, you know, like a startup, basically. It's a startup mm-hmm. activity, a university startup, which doesn't happen very often. So what's next, literally, is to make this work. Starting in a few weeks with our first big professional development course with the NHS, which is great because we've run two already. Each one was given to us by recommendation from the previous one. So that's a nice sort of reassurance that we're doing the right thing. And now we've got quite a big job with them, which again grew out of these two other things that went well. So that's the immediate future. And part of that, as I mentioned, is to kind of clarify really at the next level up what we're doing by interdisciplinarity and explain this even better, I think, than we've done mm-hmm. before. And then I suppose after this professional development gets going, next year is our first time we'll have had our final year students. So we need to support them through capstone projects and graduation. So there's plenty to do professionally. But I'm also, just to go a little off piece for a moment, I've also become addicted to triathlon. So during lockdown, when we were all going crazy from all these Zoom calls, I just started moving, basically, Vex. I mean, I lost 18 kilograms in 18 months over lockdown.
Wow.
Pretty steady. I started pootling around on my old touring bike. Then I started going 5 miles, then 20 miles, then 50 miles. I thought, oh, quite fun. Then I bought a really posh bike, started going fast. Then I started running. I hadn't run for about 30 years due to various injuries. And I started running very, very slowly and very short distances with about a week's break in between. And then I ran a bit more. And then I got up to running quite long distances, just once a week. So I have to recover a lot from my injuries, but a week is enough. Yeah. And now I'm doing really well. And my ambition, alongside establishing LIS as the most exciting new university in, well, certainly 40, if not 100 years, my ambition is to qualify for Team GB for my age group sometime in the next year or two. I'm right knocking on the door.
That's great.
My wife's sometimes a little bit annoyed that I'm running out the door to do something else rather than touching base. But she's supportive because it's kept me very healthy, actually. And it's kept me sometimes when the stress and the volume of work, which can be a lot with this sort of project, this helps me to detach and just go and do something completely different. It's actually sort of mindfulness. I'm sure some of your listeners also will recognize that the physical can also be very, very mindful. And the sort of outdoor swimming and stuff you do is very, very mentally good for you. So I love that. I love that aspect of it. I'm really enjoying having a completely different part of my life to think about sometimes.
Yeah. That's good, isn't it? Because I think we do, certainly as teachers, we know a lot about how to foster the right conditions for our children and our young people to learn best. And then we often don't apply those lessons to ourselves. So yes, in order for us to be able to challenge the system and to change things for the better for our children and young people, we have to have space for ourselves.
We have to, and we also have to walk the walk, I think. I followed the quantitative methods course with my first years this year for as much as I could. I had to drop out, unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, but I did about just over half a term with them learning Python coding, which I hadn't done before, again, to kind of show that learn. You had a lovely phrase for it, actually. It wasn't sort of learning to learn, lifelong learning. You said something else. But anyway, that you know, we never stop learning, and we're not the full stop in their learning authority at which everything ends. We're all learning all the time. So at UCL, I learned Mandarin with my students, which was fantastic. Absolutely loved it. and did really well over 5 years. I got very good at Mandarin. Now I'm going to learn some coding, and it may take me 5 years to get anywhere with that as well. But but I think, you know, it's important for me to show up as the academic leader of this new institution and say, look, I'm still learning. Every single week I'm learning, and you've just got to be quite disciplined about it, put in the hours, and that's how you'll get to where you want to get to in the longer run.
Yeah. So we are accompanying the series with a playlist of inspirational songs, and you get two spots on that playlist, Carl. So what are you going to go for?
So I thought a lot about it. It's very difficult for me as a lifelong musician and music lover. And my wife's a musician too. She's a wonderful musician. And I'm all about sort of breadth, really, and range and eclecticism and bringing different things together. And I didn't really know how to do that with one piece of music. So I've taken basically two very, very different pieces of music, which I'm not even sure you'll be able to play them. But that's it. One of them would be What is Hip? By the Tower of Power. I've only recently discovered them, but they're an amazing 70s funk band. And it's weird that I didn't know them actually, because that's my music. So growing up, I was the generation that went through the whole Rare Groove, the Sister Sledge and Chic and all that stuff. And I was in bands that played that music. I absolutely love it. But Tower of Power, What is Hip? Is a little bit earlier than that. I think that's why I didn't know them, but so funky, such an amazing groove. I love it. And then completely contrast that, I thought I'd have the first movement of Mahler's Ninth Symphony. I don't even know what 3 minutes of that sounds like. It's got these massive, long melodies, very sort of romantic, very, they just grab your heart and your stomach, if you like, even. And well, for me anyway, they make me feel very deep thoughts about the world. And couldn't really be more different from Tower of Power, but very... very great music, very important. And long may that sort of music last as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
I first came across Carl when I was attending a professional learning day at the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and I heard him talk about his way of setting up the interdisciplinary school and what that meant for how the qualifications were put together, but also what that meant in terms of the understanding of knowledge. One of the things I think is really important now is we often worry about changing the structures that we have around our teaching and learning because of that assessment tail that seemed to be wagging the pedagogical dog sometimes. And what I think is really interesting and heartening about what he's doing is that those systems are changing not only in secondary school but also in the tertiary system as well. So it's not just about those specific subject-led degrees any longer. And we have a wider understanding of what's to come. Absolutely fascinating and really interesting to hear that actually some of the things around about pedagogical thinking, we're in the schooling system a little bit further ahead in terms of what that means for our children and young people. But we can both learn a lot from one another across the different sectors. As always, please join in the conversation with hashtag Pedagogy Podcast. And if there are people that you would like us to speak to, please do let us know. Thank you for listening and speak to you soon. Bye-bye.